Yeah, Mr. Rudolph, please.
Yeah, that's that was a good one. I don't think that left a game on that. Once I stand up, I can walk far.
If you want, si vous voulez vous identifier, et puis.
Mais sans faute.
Please. I will.
And we've had many people speaking. I'd like to. My name is Tyler Rudolph. I'll give you a little bit more background shortly, but I wanted to begin by thanking NECOMX for taking this issue so seriously and for also for the thoughtful questions that were generated for the proponents. I also wanted to thank the people of Osuanapi for receiving us so well here in their community, and the great country food as well was quite sustaining on this long day. So I hope that I'll be able to keep my head together despite the fatigue that I think we're all experiencing at this very moment. So, just to give a short background, some of my associations, I've been advising the Cree Nation government since maybe 2011, 2012. We did our contract then. The report that has been mentioned, referred to several times. I now advise them on the technical committee of the Regional Task Force for Woodland Caribou Recovery. I also represent the Niskapi First Nation of Kawawachikamash on the Woodland Caribou Recovery Team. And interestingly enough, I'm part of a working group whose mandate presently is to develop guidelines for environmental assessments specifically regarding the issue of woodland caribou and how it's addressed for folks like yourselves. So I want to first begin by just acknowledging that there are a great many caribou experts in this room, and I've had the fortune of meeting some of them and being shown around on their traditional lands, and I'm very thirsty for any information that they can share with me, so I really do appreciate that, and I feel like we have complementary skills. I come from a Western science background, different scales perhaps, and we're looking at a much bigger landscape scale, and I'd like to bring that to your attention when we discuss that a little bit further. But I began studying caribou in 2002 as an intern and then a technician for the Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources, and then as an ecologist. I subsequently came to Montreal to begin my master's, in which I began in 2007, excuse me, on the woodland caribou of the James Bay. And I've been examining the behavior and the demography of this regional metapopulation for ever since. I'm essentially the primary curator of all of the data that exists for the region, and I've done probably more modeling and exploration than anyone I know. So I'm glad to be here to bring a little bit more of that science into the picture, and maybe perhaps the woodland caribou issue, you know, there's some things that maybe we could discuss in greater detail. So I'm happy to be here to do that. I guess I was, Michelle put this up for me here. We talked about what we could look at. But I guess maybe I can just start by, I think we're going to have a look at those, the proposed roads before the associated cutting that's foreseen for the next few years. And then I think we're going to move to look at what it would look like after. But to begin with, I think I just wanted to bring to the table this notion of thresholds. I think it's really important that we understand very clearly what a threshold is, how it was derived by Environment Canada, the methods used and the conclusions made by the proponents here in their recent assessment. So essentially, when you talk about a threshold, an ecological threshold, we're talking about a nonlinear relationship. So, you know, let's just say that as disturbance in a population range increases, everything's going sort of okay. Population is more or less stable, starting to decrease slightly. Gets to a certain point, we're talking 35% range disturbance according to the Environment Canada methodology and results. Starts to decline quite rapidly. And this area of greatest uncertainty, we're at the bottom of the curve all of a sudden. That's 45%. And then you go like this, and you're way down there. So it's a nonlinear relationship that it's important to understand why they chose 35% as the recommended precautionary threshold. And a threshold in science, an ecological threshold, it's a point which one would never wish to attain. The goal is to never reach the threshold. It should never be treated as a management objective or target, and it very often is. Unfortunately, in Quebec, we're in a situation where in the large majority of the province is already in a situation where we've greatly gone beyond the precautionary threshold of a maximum of 35% disturbance in a range. So, how can we do this? In the presentation that was provided by the different companies, and I should say hello to you over there because you've also been very patient and polite, very civil and generous in your in some of the offerings that you've made here. But there was one of those slides where we were looking at the forest that was left and the amount of disturbance that was estimated to exist in this zone that they've circumscribed at present and then in the next couple of years. I don't know if we can see that, but I guess the point that I wanted to make on that note is that the area that you circled, basically that's quite a big intact forest that's left. And so considering this one of the last,
With the map? So it's difficult. I don't know what's happening. I don't know who's manipulating your computer. It's difficult for me to see and to focus on
Michelle.
The image. And so just a word to the technician or whoever.
Yeah, maybe zoom out if you can, Michelle. But actually, I was talking about the presentation they made earlier today. But essentially, we're looking at, you know, one of the last intact refuges for woodland caribou on Waswanee Wanapee territory. It's an intact forest. There's not that much of it. Greenpeace presented it earlier today. My point is, when we calculate the rate of disturbance in this area, which actually has one of the last biggest intact forests left, undisturbed habitats, we're already looking presently at 42% disturbance. And that's not even the correct scale at which to measure this because you can't take an arbitrary scale and say, oh, this is the disturbance, therefore population's non-viable or population's viable. I can expand on that a little bit, but I wish we could get that slide that we looked at earlier. I think it's slide 36 of the presentation of the proponent, but if I could, to do with cumulative impacts. So this is a cumulative, obviously that's something that's been coming up, cumulative impacts assessment. We're talking about caribou, woodland caribou, we're talking about cumulative impacts assessment. For me, the only accurate scale at which to assess cumulative impacts for woodland caribou is at the scale of the population. Now this was done in 2012, this is in the report. We reported the levels of disturbance, which were, for the most part, already well in excess of 35%. So if we're looking at an area like this that's 42%, for example, and then we're looking at maybe the next 2 to 5 years of cutting, it's going to get to 45%. So already we've said 45% is theoretically not self-sustaining. But this whole idea of using a disturbance level to determine whether or not a population is self-sustaining, it's kind of like a tool that you can use to guess, okay, are they doing okay or aren't they, when you don't really have the information to actually accurately assess that. And we actually do have the information. So that's the part that I kind of thought was curious. Just to read a couple of things that I just sort of take a little bit of issue with, and I just want to clarify. We need to be perfectly honest here. The self-sustainability of the woodland caribou was concluded to be uncertain in the study area. We could say, like, maybe a regional viability. We could sort of think about that, but it doesn't really work. It's not the way. We have no evidence of that kind of a model working. We're talking about a population at a population range level, which we've already discussed. This whole idea.
Just to get you right, are you saying that looking at what's the situation today, you're not certain that the population is self-sustainable, that there's a high level of risk that it is not? Is that?
Actually, we've already concluded in our 2012 report that they were not self-sustaining. So that's a fact, actually. You know, and we did the best, I should say the best, the most thorough aerial inventory of the Assiniboine population in 2013, the best quality data, best coverage, as many animals. We actually could estimate the amount of animals in the population, and it still came out net negative. So it's a fact. We're in a situation where we're trying to play with gray areas. So my whole point of being here today is just to make it clear that it's not really a huge gray area. You have the population range. You look how disturbed is it. So then you have a theoretical, well, therefore, for example, a Seneca, you know, it's over 50% disturbed. Therefore, recruitment should be really low, like way too low. Their population is declining every year. Then you look at actually the vital rates. What's the recruitment? We've seen it. We measured it in the field in the spring many times over a decade, more than a decade. It's way low. It fits with the model. Therefore, no. They're declining. So it's kind of that's the whole point of the 2012 report. And I don't want to belabor this, but I mean it's as simple as that. If you're talking about a precautionary approach or talking about adopting a precautionary principle, I mean we're past that. And if you take a look at this kind of an area that's, you know, 42%, yet there's this big forest left. Think about, in, let's say, 2 to 5 years, it's going to be 45%. What's it going to be in 20 years? What's it going to look like? There's going to be more purple there. And I can tell you that it's going to look exactly like any other cookie-cutted piece that you would take south of this in Waswanapi territory. It's going to look just like that in 20 years. And is there going to be caribou there? I can state with quite a good degree of confidence that there probably won't be any caribou there. There might be residual animals. And so this brings me to the other point, which is we're talking about, we brought up this, I think it's very good, the analysis that was done. You know, you brought the points. There's some things to do with that that could be done better, but it doesn't matter. We saw that, and I've used quantitative techniques to demonstrate that. So we're still talking about the range of the metapopulation. Actually, we're talking about the area of overlap between the Assiniboine and the Nottoway populations. And I actually did a recent, I was commissioned to do a quantitative analysis of connectivity of the habitats that are left. And this very forest, this broadback forest, believe it or not, when we look at these two populations, Assiniboine and Nottoway, is the number one most important forest for the maintenance of functional landscape connectivity for caribou at the regional scale. And that's really important when we consider that the Nottoway population range is actually not that disturbed, somewhere in the range of 35%, 33 or something like that. A lot of that's not forestry, but there's quite a bit of forestry there too, but it's most of the range is above the northern limit. So we take the fact that the Assiniboine population is declining and probably quite rapidly. Well, if we don't change what we're doing, like harvesting in critical core use areas, for example, as is happening at present, well, we're going to have to count on some other animals coming in and, you know, bolstering the population. And if we isolate, if we functionally fragment and we don't allow movement to take place in genetic exchange between the Nodaway and the Seneca, then the long-term prospects of success are, you know, we're talking about creating a refuge population like Val-d'Or. Things like, there's so many points that I made here. But I did want to say that one of the examples that we're looking at earlier, we noted that actually to the east of the lake here, there's a bunch of these purple cuts, et cetera. And they're saying, well, why did you do that? That's not what we should be examining, sort of thing. Like, hey, let's think about this. Why did you present that? Did you need to? Well, actually, that's really great, I think, looking at things from a cumulative impacts perspective. I think, COMEX, it's really important that maybe you have multiple piggybacking projects, you know, that you're evaluating at the same time, but guess what? From a caribou perspective, they all affect population at the same time. Now, despite that we don't have a great deal of use, recorded use by caribou in this area that we're looking at right now, we do have, in the recent past, we have knowledge from local trappers of caribou in these areas. And that confirms the fact that we also had some points in there. It's just a lower, it's at the outskirts of what we'd consider the population range. Now, does that mean that it's okay just to, you know, go in there and harvest it all? There's a lot of things to add, so I'm just going to add them as I go. We can't say that mosaic cutting has been great for caribou. It creates a lot of roads. It disperses the cutting everywhere, creates roads everywhere. Hasn't been good for caribou. Now, is there a way to fix that? Sure, there's been discussions. I think mosaic cutting works for the Cree people. It would be hard to do that. And so because roads are the main issue, are we going to regenerate roads? Restore them? I think the answer to that is clearly no. Do we have any evidence of any road restoration in recent years? I would say no. We've had a lot of people putting it on paper that are getting certified and recertified with FSC. Is it happening? No. Is it complicated? Yes. Are there legal issues? Yes. Is it expensive? Probably. In a lot of circumstances, it's quite expensive. Is it feasible or realistic? At a scale such as this that we're looking at in this example? Not really. So if we're trying to seriously put, invest in protection at this stage or in success, in caribou, in population recovery, really I've said this before, the best chance that we have of succeeding in ensuring population recovery is by protecting the most habitat that we can right now, and the most important ones. I said that before, but in terms of, I think there's just one more main point that I wanted to make about this that I've been getting to for some time. It has to do with resilience, and it also has to do with the modeling approach that was used to look at future disturbances. We looked at how the chief forester does it versus Environment Canada. Chief Forester uses, you know, what we call them, the Dani Forestière, Eco Forestière. They're at a higher resolution. Are they better than satellite imagery? Probably I'd say that for the most part in research, you don't want to have too high of a resolution when you're looking at caribou because they have I've seen a lot of studies, it's 100 meters, 250 meters, 500 meters. It's kind of okay so is that better? When we're looking at future, and I was going to ask this question, what would be the disturbance rate in 20 years in this area that we're looking at? That's one question. And the other one would be, what will have been the impact of fire in 20 years? How does that factor into our calculation? Is there a great risk of fire in this area? Well, it's quite quite a high risk of fire in this area. In fact, that's one of the reasons why the longer-term forecasts that the Chief Forester's methods were able to procure in my opinion, significantly underestimate the amount of disturbance that will occur in this region. So I don't think that the current strategy, as it is, if we can put that on the table right now, they've done the simulations, they've put the precautionary approach, temporary patch. In 100 years, one big rotation will happen. Well, we're kind of still at 35, which is way better than elsewhere in Quebec. So, okay. I'm not saying that there's not big sacrifices to make. That's not my job. And I like it that way. I can only answer to the caribou issue. So I apologize for having to be frank about some of these things. But it's quite clear that, for example, if we take that as an example, if we cut all this now, we have the swath above the broadback, which is fairly, heavily used by animals of both the Nottoway and the Seneca population. It's a really important area of overlap. I think it's 98% of the area of overlap of the Seneca and the Nottoway herd is in the broadback forest. It captures
north. Broadback north.
South of the, hang on, I got it written down here.
98% of the area where they overlap, it's north, not south of the broadback.
Anyways, one thing I was going to say earlier, we can clarify this. I have a presentation and I have the results of this analysis and I have some other things, and I was thinking about actually just making it more structured and presenting you with that for your review. But that's important, is this concept of resilience. So, sure, we can cut all this. We can say, well, there's not a lot of caribou there right now. It's only 42%. It's only going to be 45, but in reality, it's going to be a lot more in 20 years. They will have cut a lot more. There will have been fires. Future estimations of this, that's more in the simulations. They don't actually put buffers around the future cut blocks, so there's an underestimation. It could go up to 1.5 times more disturbance than it actually produces. So anyway, so it won't look good in this area. You might still have above. Then what happens if it gets hit with a fire? Then you're kind of, what are you going to do? There's not really a lot to do. It's going to really, separate them, functionally isolate the two populations for quite a time until there's enough recovery that you can still travel through. Who knows what the predation risk, that they would encounter there is. If we take a shorter term, I'm almost done. If we take a shorter term time horizon and we say, okay, there's no fire that's going to happen there, it's going to regenerate by the time the fire comes. This thing to do with avoidance and of roads and functional habitat loss, really to look at the functional habitat lost with the road, I would recommend using the behavior of caribou during the winter, which is, and I've modeled it just like the model they've described. I did that for the winter, and it's the inflection point is 1.5 kilometers. So that's more accurate because that's a reflection of caribou behavior and not of some demographic model, habitat model. That's one is the 500 meters is part of the Environment Canada approach to try to predict the sustainability or viability of a population based on how much disturbance is there. Functional habitat loss is the result of behavioral avoidance of roads by caribou, and that should be more along in the order of 1.5 kilometers suggested. What else am I going to say? I've been talking your ears off here. You guys must be tired. Must be somebody else that needs to...
3 minutes.
3 minutes, okay. Something to do with... that was it. When I did my master's work on woodland caribou of the James Bay region, the spring dispersal time, highest adult mortality since spring dispersal. Females, these are females that we're tracking and we're estimating survival from. They're, with child, they're carrying their newborns in their bellies. They're all of a sudden leaving. They're traveling significant distances, tens, twenties, hundreds of kilometers sometimes. Their energy reserves are low. highest rates of adult mortality. Now, what I looked at is the kind of path that they take during spring dispersal, and I determined that female caribou that were dispersing in spring to get to their calving site where they would give birth, and it's very important that there's a protected area where a site where they're not going to be detected by predators and their baby will be eaten up like that, for example, by a black bear or a wolf. That's the problem with the disturbance recruitment relationship that Environment Canada has modeled. It has to do with the calves, not necessarily the adults, although we do know that as disturbances increase, adult survival decreases as well. Now, what I found was these females that were traveling to their calving sites were located within 30 kilometers of a highly eroded area, and that turned out to be about 0.5 kilometers per kilometer squared, which is, you guys have probably seen a lot more roads in areas. Those animals tended to travel in circles. They never really finished any great distance from where they started, and they were close to a road network where predation risk is higher and presumably mortality of the young is higher, whereas others that were further away from highly eroded areas, they traveled further distances and they went more straight. And my hypothesis would be that they had greater success in rearing their young. So just an example of how roads can affect, I did another type of behavioral thing where I determined that road density had an impact on caribou behavior up to 15 kilometers at distances. And I wasn't the only one. So my whole point is that there's no fires. We do all this cutting. It looks like it looks everywhere else in the region. There's a distinct possibility that we will have created conditions that are impacting the caribou that are still frequenting the area north of the river because the front de coupe, the cutting has reached and the roads have reached so close to where they all, the intensively used areas, that these animals, you're going to impact them whether you like it or not, because that's the beauty of this situation, is there's such a buffer there. And either way, by doing this, it's going to bring the disturbance rates up, and you're going to jeopardize somewhat this, a chunk of this forest, which is determined to be the most important forest for maintaining functional landscape connectivity for the regional meta population. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation. For sure, we'll be reviewing your statement. If you have any documentation that you'd like to send, you're more than welcome. We've been actively learning on the topic.
If you were following, though, all along, I noticed you.
I'm trying. I'm getting more and more concept, but I'm learning fast. But I understand that the complex question of establishing the scale on which you and I guess it's a series of hypotheses that you need to establish before fixing what would be the scale of the study. Because, what's the concept of a regional horde? What's regional?
Well, the best way to estimate is with telemetry data, and that's exactly what we did, and we have very, very good data set over more than a decade now. So you can very accurately estimate the probability of caribou in, their range contours, and that's exactly what you should be doing. It's within those population range contours that you should be estimating disturbance rates.
How do you establish a contour? We have the picture of where they are.
Yeah.
How do you establish the contours?
Yeah. See, that's just a zoom in though of the entire range, and you're looking at an overlapping area of two different populations. So, kind of got to look at it for two different populations, or look at it for the whole thing for both. Yeah. You got to think about it in that way. But it's basically quantitative methods. Objective quantitative. Derivation of contours via probability intervals and such.
Okay,
it's quite boring.
I understand that,
I have, when you were talking about the range contours, that was the question I was trying to get at earlier, because it almost sounds like you're saying the same thing, in that when we say, okay, here's the contour, this is where the caribou, I find it strange when people say, this is where the caribou are. as if that's where they've always been, and that's their natural.
Yeah, and
but it's funny that the contour follows exactly where operations are. So it's a chicken and the
egg. There's a bit of overlap here because we've got over 10 years of data. So we're like part of the area that we include as the range is from points that are probably no longer reflecting, you know, where the caribou actually are. But it's a very strong relationship. Actually, we're going to be submitting an article to Biological Conservation perhaps next week. It's been a long time coming, but it's explores this very question in depth using vital rates from the region, and our conclusion is really that 35% is pretty quite accurate for the vital rates that we're seeing in our region based on the model that we've tested using our empirical data, and also that it's quite sensitive to changes. So, for example, if there's not as many females, there's not a good ratio of females to males, there are not enough females to males in a population, then all of a sudden you're not going to get enough recruitment to compensate for adult mortalities. So it's really a sensitive balance, and the 35% is just a national, it's just a mean coming from a model, and you get variation on both sides, but you do not want to go more than 35% if you can. If you have the option of continuing to go because you think it's a great area and because it's not that bad, and for example, and I just thought this was interesting that the promoters consider that the woodland caribou still has assets for self-sustainability. I don't know if the promoters are well positioned to make that kind of conclusion. That's just my professional opinion. And they mentioned that Environment Canada's latest assessment was self-sustaining. But in fact, they didn't even have the data then when they did that. They said all of northern Quebec was a caribou population, and it was doing great. But we know better because we studied it in depth when we were commissioned by the Quebec government and the Grand Council of the Crees. So I'm sorry for taking up so much time.
Brian had a question, I thought.
Please.
I just have one question. I remember in Waskaganish, below the community of Waskaganish, in that area that's quite far from the Nottoway River, but is about, I don't know, I guess it was about 40 miles south of Waskaganish. There was a herd of caribou at that time that I remember. It was the first time I'd been in the community. And we went out and saw the animals and so on. They hunted them, actually. And there were a number of them there. I mean, I'm thinking of maybe 200 or 300 in that area.
What time of year was it?
It was in the spring, early spring. Do woodland caribou have many migrations? Do they change from one area to another? So that is it possible that they would, mm-hmm. every 30 years or so, change location because they're running out of food or something?
I'd like to say that I had data to support that. I'd say I don't. Most of the data would seem to indicate the contrary, mostly because of the phenomenon of site fidelity. So the females will always come back to within a given, for the data that I studied up until 2011 maybe, it was within about 20-kilometer radius of the same calving site where they actually gave birth. So that's pretty tight when you think about the size of these regions. And they can change their wintering areas often, but they always end up coming back, and that's pretty consistent across the board. And when you look at the telemetry program, I agree, and I've recognized that interesting work that was done to collect traditional knowledge on woodland caribou in around 2010 with some Environment Canada money. And they noted more or less in the region you're looking at, I mean, it's more Nemiska, there were caribou up there and woodland caribou, and we actually had more than one animal that at some point had just, you know, beelined it way up there, and they were there. And we were just like, okay, and we figured that they followed the migratory caribou because they were at the same time of year, and then they must have realized they were lost and they came back. But apparently they have resident animals up there for many years, and I know there were smaller, little groups that are known, but When you look at the quality of the habitat up there and you look at the amount of animals we've collared and the evidence of how far north they'll go, there's some outliers that go up and they come back, and it's there's really not a great deal of woodland caribou activity that we've been able to identify. I say we when I mean the actually the provincial government biologists, but that's an area that certainly could stand further research efforts in collaboration with the Cree peoples. That would certainly be interesting to do. But we know that this population that we're looking at is quite distinct, just to clear that up. Thank you.
Merci beaucoup.
Thank you very much.
That would be our last presentation. And